Welcome, everyone. I'm William Bloom, and this Compassion Dialogue is with Mark Silver. Welcome, Mark. Thank you for being with us. Before properly introducing you, a few words about this series of dialogues. It's hosted by the Spiritual Companions Trust, which is a UK educational charity. We develop resources for people who are spiritual, but not necessarily religious. In all these dialogues, our purpose is to explore what influences, motivates, and inspires influential spiritual authors, teachers, and activists, and hopefully inspires you too. More love, more compassion, more consciousness. Coming up in a few weeks, I'll be talking with Dr. Michelle Yah Asantewiwa. I hope I pronounced it properly. She's originally from Guyana, and Michelle is an author, academic, poet, and activist who specializes in African spirituality, traditional African spirituality, and its practices. And her many publications include Guyanese Komfa, the ritual art of trance. So she'll be talking with us about the traditions that she's studied and experienced. And now to Mark. Those of you who read any of my e-letters that went out saying, hey, Mark's coming on to this dialogue, you'll know that I rate him really, really highly, genuinely. This is because in the decades that I've been engaged in spirituality, I've come across many consultants, coaches, advisors who seek to integrate spirituality into good business practice and support all kinds of individuals, especially healing therapy practitioners and green businesses get off the ground. But almost without exception, they've all been primarily focused on the bottom line and financial success, and the love, compassion, relational aspect has kind of got sidelined. And then several decades ago, maybe 25 years ago, I came across Mark's work at the Heart of Business. And since then, I read it at the time. He's got a new version of it out in this book, Heart-Centered Business, which I'll plug again later on. But since then, my wife Sabrina and I have sent many, many clients to Mark because we really, really trust him. So Mark, it's a real pleasure to chat with you. The funny thing is we've done loads of email communications to each other, but never actually spoken in real life.
I know, it's so funny. I feel such an obvious miss all these years. And so I'm glad that I'm finally connecting like this. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. I'm so happy you said yes. So listen, lovely man. Tell us about your childhood, what the inspirations were. And because I know you came from a Jewish family, but you then later on segued into Sufism. But I'm curious about whether there was spirituality in your household, you know, what kind of parenting you had that led you into being a carer of others and a coach for others, and what kind of spiritual experiences you may have been having as a child or as a young person that led you down this path. So tell us as much as you want to and can about all of that.
Yeah, we could use all the time just talking history, right? I grew up, my family, both sides are Eastern European Jewish. My mom's parents were Orthodox and direct immigrants. And my dad's parents were born here. I believe my great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents were the immigrants. And I was not raised very spiritually. We were raised Jewish in that we went to high holiday services and we belonged to synagogue, and I went to Hebrew school and had my bar mitzvah. But I we were not, there was not a strong practice of Judaism. We didn't keep Shabbat. We didn't, you know, we didn't keep kosher. It wasn't, some of the outer practices were not there. Although, as I think many Jews feel, there was a deep felt sense of being Jewish and, you know, MOT, member of the tribe, as we say. And it's funny because I don't have strong spiritual memories from my childhood. I remember thinking, oh, I'm going to be a rabbi at some point. I remember having that thought. And I think I've become a bit of a rabbi, even though I'm not, you know, even though it's not Jewish. But it's interesting. But my parents ran a store, a retail store that was my grandfather's before. My grandfather was a pharmacist who sold alcohol by prescription during Prohibition here in the States in the 1930s when alcohol was illegal, and then opened a wine store afterwards. And the wine store was the family business. And I grew up in that. And my parents were they're still alive. They're deeply caring people. They're deeply caring people. They cared about their customers in the store because it was a neighborhood store. And they had the same customers for decades. And they had deep relationships in the community. And there was a deep sense of caring that I was raised with. But it's funny that my sense of inner spiritual connection wasn't regained. And I say regained because I think all children naturally, you know, we were born with it and we have it. And then it's this Western culture we're in, we tend to lose it. It tends to not be supported in most environments. And so, I wouldn't say that I was deeply spiritual, and it really, like, it's something that I didn't come back to until I was out of college, out of university, and living in San Francisco at the time.
Ask you, teenager, were you kind, nice boy, or were you a bit of a adventurer? What kind of kid were you?
As a teenager, I was a punk. I was in the DC punk scene, mm-hmm. straight edge punk, very political. We were, we were out there protesting the street rock against Reagan and, you know, out in front of the South African embassy and I think my sense of caring and connection came from that. You know, came from being politicized as a young man, and in very kind of more radical left-wing politics. And although I wasn't educated about it, my parents have been very conservative politically. So we were always at odds on that front. I don't think they quite understood where I was coming from, what was going on. I didn't, you know, what is this kid up to?
Did you dress like a punk? I mean,
I mean, sure. You know, yeah. Ripped army fatigues and funny haircut and, you know, the engineer boots and the whole thing.
Okay, what was your funny haircut?
Well, it was really short at one point. It was a flat top at one point. At one point it was shaved.
Okay.
One half was shaved and then like a diagonal across the back. So, yeah, it was before internet and phone. So there's not really many photos left from that era, but yeah. You know, dyed it red at one point.
Okay. Let me bring us back from that cul-de-sac. So there you were, a punk activists showing social awareness.
Yes.
In college?
Yeah, continued. I started out, one of my interests was computers actually from the age of 13. And so I started university in computer science, but I got so it was in a life. It was like I was living in the computer lab basement on Jolt Cola and M&Ms, and I was like, I can't support this. So anyway, I switched to have an English literature major with a French minor, and I actually studied in France, but I continued to be politically active. We did a lot around abortion clinic defense, did a lot. There were a lot of protests against the president of the university, who was really terrible in a lot of ways, just, just way more capitalist and expansive and not as caring as we wanted to see. And like that. I think that I was also, you know, the other thread that kind of runs through all of this is that I was really deeply shut down emotionally. And I was not strong. I was not particularly athletic. And punk for me, you know, and I was a bit of a nerd, you know, before punk, when I was, you know, I was into Dungeons and Dragons before it was cool, you know, when it was like in its infancy. And punk for me was also a bit of a mask. And it was a way to protect myself. And I told myself, I'm not crying anymore, because I used to cry really easily. And I lost the ability to cry, and it took me many years to get that back. And in fact, I came out as bisexual in college, and that was the beginning of reclaiming my emotional world, you know, my ability to just the softness in me and the tenderness, and, you know, it's okay to cry, and it's okay to, you know, be soft. Don't have to, you know, be so, you know, I won't say tough, because I wasn't tough. I was never a tough person, but I was shut down. I was masked in ways that were really, I would say painful, but it was a numbness. You know, other men who might have had that experience might relate, because emotions were not welcome in young boys. You know, the wrong emotions were not welcome.
So there you are in your early 20s, discovering, or your soul's softness is emerging.
Mm-hmm.
The shielding of being a punk is beginning to melt or disintegrate.
Yeah. Yes.
And what happened?
Yeah, it's which thread to follow is always the question in these moments. You know, I graduated. I guess in college I had relationships. I had a boyfriend for a little while. I had a couple girlfriends for a while. It was kind of a little back and forth, and when I graduated, I ended up moving to Rhode Island for a relationship with a woman, and she was a wonderful person, really fascinating. We had a 2-year relationship, and it was during that time that she had this gift where dead people would visit her. Like, she knew, like, she spoke to the dead really easily. And she told me many stories of being visited by people just when they died. And, you know, like when she was young, and her mom would come in and say, oh, I have to tell you, your grandfather died. And she goes, oh, I know, I saw him earlier, and he said goodbye. And, you know, like those kinds of experiences. And she kind of began my spiritual opening, you know, like my awareness and awakeness to other, you know, beyond the physical reality. And so when that relationship ended, I moved to San Francisco. I had other friends who had moved there right after graduation. And that was another spiritual opening for a number of reasons. One is that ending up in queer community in San Francisco and knowing, starting to meet and spend time with, if you're familiar with Radical Fairies, it's a spiritual gay men being spiritual, you know, and that the gayness itself is spiritual. And it was actually the Billy Club, which is very similar to. So it's like, there was this deeper opening. There was this like deeper softness and awareness that was happening. And then at the same time, I became involved with Jewish community, queer Jewish community there. Which was also kind of earth-based Judaism. There was this deep sense of connection to the earth and finding that in the earliest history of Judaism as like, you know, being based in the seasons. And then it was also an intersection with Starhawk's reclaiming community, which was quite active in San Francisco at that point. I don't know what it's like these days, but it was quite active. And so, and it was then that I met Holly, who's my wife, and we've been together for 30 years. And she, and so there was this real, how to make it coherent and not go on for hours and hours, right? It's like, there was an opening, like I started to open and I started to feel very kind of fumbling and not knowing how to open more deeply. And like, okay, so I need something more spiritually. I need something more. I need more guidance, more grounding. Like, I don't know what I'm doing or how to connect. It's not something that's really easy for me to do. Holly has always had like a much easier time opening. Like she'll sit and she'll meditate or pray or do practices for hours. She'll stay. It's like, for me, I kind of cling to my spiritual practices by my fingertips. It's a little bit rough and ready. And it was about that time that a friend of hers, her best friend, had a friend who was studying with the Sufis. And we got connected to Sufi teachers at that point. There was a sheikh, my sheikh, Sidi Muhammad al-Jamal Rafai Shadali, who was from Palestine. He was born and raised in Jerusalem. He was a teacher at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. He died in 2015, but he traveled the world teaching Sufism, including
the States. Let me pause you for a second, Mark.
Yes.
Tell everybody what Sufism is.
Yes. So Sufism is the mystical practice of Islam. Like if you think of Kabbalah and Judaism, you think of the Gnostics in Christianity, you think of the Sufis in Islam. And the poets Rumi and Hafiz are Sufis, although the most common translations we see of them aren't actual translations of their work. They're renditions that are not very faithful. But anyway, it's popularized them. So it's like this deep desire, and I like the practice of how do you stay present to the oneness in every moment? How do you carry the love in every moment, in even the most difficult places? And there was a healing school. And, you know, before that, I was like, okay, so if I'm going to go deeper, like, are we going to be kosher? Like, am I going to become more Orthodox with my Judaism? Like, what am I going to do? And Holly went and spent time. She also has a Jewish background as well. And she spent time like, don't go Sufi on me, because it's just, there's a discomfort, you know, between Judaism and Islam that shouldn't be there, because it's basically the same religion. You know, the Quran mentions the Torah many, many times. And there's more that I could say about that. But I was really drawn in, and I had like the first of my adult life, like really profound connection to my heart, where I could really, like after spending time with one of the teachers, one of the American teachers that my sheikh had trained, and my heart opened. And I could feel things and see things that I couldn't see before. And it was interesting because we were spending time with the Sufi teachers and spending time with the Jewish community. and the teachings were the same, like they were on parallel tracks, but my experience with the Sufis was deeper. I won't say that there was a difference. It was like my personal path, like I was being led on that. So it was deeper for me in that experience. And when I decided, okay, well, we're going to, you know, Holly and I decided we're going to go to this healing school. It's a 3-year training with the Sufis to learn spiritual healing. And actually one of the main teachers here in the US was a business consultant, and they were teaching business healing. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, like a heart of business was starting up, and I was starting to do that kind of work. Let me pause you.
So go back maybe 12 months, because you just said the heart of business was just starting up.
Well, the heart of business launched as heart of business in the middle of my Sufi training. But in 1999, I started the training in 2000. 1999 is when I first started working with entrepreneurs. I had, before that, I had been a paramedic for my paid job. That was a whole thing that got left out of this whole story, is that that was a former career. So I spent as a paramedic in Oakland, California, in the Bay Area counties, and the Knife and Gun Club. Lots of fun stuff there. And I was also, as a volunteer, the managing editor for the bisexual magazine, one of the only bisexual magazines that was in existence. I was running that. It was titled Anything That Moves, and which was very cheeky and fun. I'm losing the thread of what I was saying.
Well, I tell you, you must have noticed somewhere in there that you knew how to support somebody with an entrepreneurial instinct.
Well, that's what happened. Yes, right. Because I had run the magazine and I had grown up in business, I didn't realize this until much later, but as a paramedic, I didn't realize that the skill translated so well, being able to hold people in really difficult places, like hold space when people are having like really, really difficult situations going on. And so we had friends who were self-employed, organic gardeners, someone who, different kinds of healers, holistic healers, just friends in our circle in the Bay Area and Berkeley and Oakland and San Francisco. And I started helping them, and I knew more than I thought I knew. And
what kind of help?
Marketing. It's because I'd run a magazine and I had Quark Express and I had a computer. I was helping people do trifold brochures, which were a thing at the time. Those who remember those days in the 90s and earlier. But it's like, I was a terrible designer. I was a terrible, terrible designer. But to fill out the brochures, I had to help them figure out what to say and how to price themselves. And people were really like struggling. And so that was one of the things that also sparked me to go on the healing journey with the Sufis, because I'm like, oh my God, people have all these really hard, like challenging emotions around business. I need to know how to process people. And I was like, Holly, should I do hypnotherapy? She had trained in hypnotherapy. She goes, No, that's not it. And then we came across the Sufi training, and I'm like, this is where I'm supposed to be. Like, this is where I'm supposed to be. So that feeling of rightness. And we stepped into that. And then it was in the Sufi training that I started to like, I was geeking out on the esoteric stuff, like these really esoteric spiritual teachings. And I was starting to be shown, I could see in my heart, like how they overlaid, how business practices could be like the physical manifestation of certain esoteric teachings. And I'm like, what? So like an example of something that I saw was, there's a healing, you know, I was being taught how to take people through a healing process. And I saw, and then I had learned like the template of the structure of a marketing message from Robert Middleton, who's in California, action plan marketing. He retired just recently. He's been doing it even longer than I have, more than 30 years. And he's huge integrity and a huge heart, tremendous person. Really glad I learned from him. But then I saw that the order of the process to take someone through healing overlaid on the when you create a marketing message of integrity. And I was like, really? Like, does that really match up? And I started to see this over and over again in different parts of business. Like, oh, there are spiritual teachings that are behind worldly things that have integrity. And then there are things that don't have that spiritual backing. And maybe we don't have to do it that way. Maybe we can let that go. So, and so that started to come in more and more and more. And I was also working for another business coach. And it was clear that I just was not in alignment with her. She was doing things spiritually that didn't, I wasn't in alignment with what she was doing. And I left. And then that's when I started Heart of Business. And I started it. It launched the day after 9/11. I always had good timing. Started Islamic Sufi-based thing right after 9/11. Nice timing there, Mark. But is this interesting to listen to? I feel
It is.
Yeah.
What I'm immediately curious about is I'd love to hear one of the early examples of a particular project where the healing template, you could superimpose that on the business project and go, oh, okay, I can see how this flows.
So one of the basic approaches to healing is that you start out by helping people feel witnessed and seen. Like they have to feel witnessed and seen and cared for, even in their struggles. And they're, you can't just jump into healing. Like people need to feel seen where they are and not feel broken, not feel like you're seeing them as broken. See them as whole and there's challenges. So they feel deeply seen and contained and held. And then from there, there's a possibility that once they do that, there's an opening of like, oh, what I've been doing hasn't been working. What's the shift? Like, what am I missing? What is it about my perspective that wasn't seeing the full truth? And then you can be, and then once that opens, it's like a switch and they can click into a place where they can be supported and guided into seeing deeper truths and deeper openings and deeper realities, sometimes with gentle guidance. Now, a marketing message, what Robert Middleton called the executive summary, but I kind of like tweaked and worked with to kind of match it up a little bit more closely with what I wanted to do, I call the customer focused story. It starts with deep empathy. You start with like speaking to someone where they are. And this is like such an important piece because anybody who teaches marketing effectively says you have to talk to the problem. But most marketing is based on a re-traumatizing pattern where they name it in a way that creates agitation, creates a reaction. And then they keep poking it until there's such a strong reaction that the only way to get soothing is to purchase. Most marketing functions like that on some level. It's manipulative, it's harmful, it's toxic, it's wrong. But people still need to be witnessed where they are. So if I can witness someone where they are, and I can also in that witnessing name things that they've already tried so they can be seen as having like not just been sitting on their butts, like they've been working on this. I can take a breath. I can feel witnessed and cared for while I'm witnessing them, while seeing them as whole. They're not broken. They're just, they're just running into a problem like so many of us have. And then there's a shift. It's like, what's missing? Like introducing the piece, what the things that you've tried, they've been missing perhaps this perspective. whatever that perspective is. You know, they've been missing something. There's something. And then with that opening, then they can start to, you can start to guide them and say, like, here's the principles of my work. And in particular, in the marketing message, I speak to the principles, not as if there's some kind of special IP of mine, but they're principles that are available in the world. Like, they don't have to get them through me. They can get them on their own or find them elsewhere. So they can feel empowered. They can, we can feel like we're in the same world. And in the healing work, it's the same thing. Like, I don't own spiritual healing, but there might be some principles that I'm leading someone to. Like, okay, here's a divine quality that's available to everyone that maybe might be helpful to you in the situation. Or here's a, you know, here's some guidance. There's, you know, depending on what's going on, there's different things you can do. But it's something that's available. Yes.
Just for a second. Because the 3-year Sufi healing training, mm-hmm. that sounds like a form of talk therapy guided by spiritual principles with insights from Sufi teaching. Would that be right? As opposed to
I wouldn't call it. It's not somatic. It's not body. It's like not, it wasn't a hands-on healing.
You don't radiate energy.
Yes, we do. But I wasn't touching people. You know, it's okay. Like it wasn't like body work.
So you're bringing through a healing energy.
Bringing through a healing energy, a transmission. I was in the lineage, in that Sufi lineage. And so I had access to the transmission through the lineage, sure. Have access through it. You know, there were very particular prayers and different types of healing work that were brought through that, you know, that have a transmission in them. And I wouldn't call it, although of course we were speaking, there's a lot of not speaking that happened. So I would differentiate it from talk. Sure. Healing.
So when you're working with a
talk therapy
part, yeah. of business client, you're bringing those skills that you personally possess into the relationship.
Yes.
With the person who's trying to get their business off the ground or improve it.
Yes.
And you're, yes. guiding them into clarity about how to do it in a way that's ethical and loving.
Yes. Yes. So it's a combination of, there are things that I have figured out or, you know, like integrated spiritually with business practices. So there's an element of just like, you know, here's how to do it. Like, you don't have to figure it out entirely on your own. But there's also an element of like, you have to find your own connection in your heart and your own sense of love and your own alignment, because I don't want you just monkey see monkey do what I tell you. Like, it has to integrate. Like, you have to feel it. Like, you have to, although we have templates and we have things that we show people how to do things, we're always also teaching the principles underneath them. So if somebody needs to tweak something to be more in alignment for themselves, you know, we're not trying to create cookie cutter businesses or have everybody do everything exactly the same.
The heart, yeah. of what you're doing, for example, would you be wanting people to be in relationship with their own work and their own project in a way that's loving and supportive for them and valuable for them, even before they start to do any outreach with it?
Yeah. You know, so one of the tenets or beliefs or experiences of Sufism is that everything comes from the divine. Everything is an expression of the divine. And as such, anything can be a mirror for the divine. And I mean, everything can have a heart and everything, we can connect with anything. And so we encourage clients to have a relationship with the heart of their business, to start to be with the heart of their business as a separate being from them. This is, it's obvious in larger businesses, even not spiritually, that there's something separate from the person. But in tiny businesses, that's not always so obvious. And people get really gummed up thinking that it's all them. when in fact there's another beingness there that with the right support and the right care and the right relationship can grow and develop to the point where it can carry you and it can do things on its own, which sounds funny when you're self-employed, but how else would you describe a website that can, you know, sign people up on a newsletter list and deliver things without you having to do anything, or, you know, other kinds of systems that you put in place? You can call them mechanical systems, or you can see them as expressions of a living beingness that you're helping to put into place so that it can be an expression of love and presence in the world.
But whether or not the project is financially successful, the individual business person develops love and awareness and consciousness by virtue of the transformation they have in relationship to their work.
That's a beautiful way to put it. It's we of course want our clients to be financially successful, and we help them do that because you got to pay the rent, you got to live your life, you got to, you know, food in the fridge, etc. And so that's something that we do pay close attention to. We want people who are doing really good things in the world to be supported, you know, financially. But that can't come from any kind of compromise in our relationship with love, with oneness, with a sense of collective care for the entire world, for everything around us, with a collective care for social justice and for, you know, for the vulnerable and the needy.
Okay, so we're anchoring in love and awareness between the individual business person and their business. And then they've got this big wrestling match, which is to express it, you know, to express it into the world.
Uh-huh.
And make some money out of it. And yeah. I mean, the reason why Sabrina and I have sent so many people to you was one of the metaphors we used for these folk was they're coming out of several incarnations as nuns, monks, clergy people, where the religious tradition they were in provided them with a platform and they didn't have to do any marketing. And then suddenly now they're little individuals in the world needing to market themselves, and they find it vulgar, they find it difficult, they found it disempowering, they don't like the struggle.
No.
Because you're having to push against commercial energy in order to get your service, your offer out there. So what's your hand holding there on that bit of the process for them?
Well, the first piece of hand holding is to honor their resistance. Like I start the book out by saying, if you have issues with business, I don't want you to get over them. You know, I have not lost any of my critique of capitalism in my work with small businesses. You know, human beings have had all different kinds of forms of trade and commerce our entire existence on the planet in many different cultures. But capitalism, the last few hundred years, has been noxious and toxic and deadly and miserable. And so there's a real wisdom. To be spiritually courageous means that we're not willing to just turn away from things that upset us. Like, we need to be able to lean in. And one of the foundational questions I have people ask is love available even here? If you're facing some aspect of your business that has felt gross out in the world, yes, you have encountered something that is truly gross. Do not doubt your senses in any way. You have been treated badly. Many people have been treated badly and unfairly and unjustly. Many people have been injured and killed. This is wisdom. But lean in. is there something else? Is love available even here? Can we find love in the world of sales? Can we find love in the world of marketing, in the world of systems, in the world of business? Is there a possibility of finding something nuanced and clear and clean and good in all of this? And that courage pays off, because that, I think, I mean, at least that's what my Sufi teachers taught me. It's like our, like the job of the human being is to see the divine in everything. And just because business in particular has been miserable doesn't mean that the divine is absent. It doesn't mean that the love is absent. It means that it's been ignored or covered over or twisted in some way by humans. And so we don't have to bring it there. We have to discover it and bring it out. And then so much becomes possible. You know, I've had people who've come to us hating marketing, and then they learn to love it. They learn to love it, not love what they hated, but love the act of being in healthy relationship, of bringing their gifts to people, of supporting them, of engaging, you know, in a way that both is aligned with their personality and is aligned with their values and their morals and their skills and their gifts, you know, finding their way through.
Okay. Well, listen, I'm bubbling with something, and I'm not sure whether I'm going to take us off piste, which is what sometimes happens in these conversations. But I'm thinking of the Bay Area in California 30 years ago, and 40 years ago as well. I knew it quite well myself. And there was an idealism and a beauty in the way that the new spirituality was being expressed, i.e. the diversity and the inclusivity and the integration of holistic medicine and healthcare into. And then... market forces, commercial forces, kind of
devastated the city.
Well,
and the
took
area.
It over, but not just the Bay Area. I'm talking about what was called New Age stuff.
Yes, it got co-opted by capitalism.
Got co-opted and commercialized. So, what's your? I see you nodding in agreement. You know, I've had to move to a stance that's more kind of philosophical and going, okay, mm-hmm. It's just the way it goes. But I'm curious what your take is on that.
I think that's, you know, one of the things that capitalism does so well is it pushes the narrative that that it's not a thing, that it's just the way it is, that it's just natural. And the truth is that for the vast majority of cultures in history of the U.S., of humanity, capitalism hasn't been a thing. There's so many different other ways we can organize ourselves. And capitalism arose out of a very particular time and place in Europe and was spread through white supremacy and slavery and empire, and it's not the way it just is. It's terrible, and it's a cancer, and it takes things over. And so we need to have an awareness of that, because without having an awareness of that, we can be it's easier to lose hope if we don't have a sense of what it is that we're in. Like if you're swimming in the ocean in a riptide, you may lose hope trying to swim against it. But if you get swept out, but if you know how a riptide works, you can like swim around it and not have to drown. You know, I hate to be so graphic. He's the paramedic in me. I'm not afraid to talk about death and trauma, but it's like, we don't have to be, we can give a healthy respect and awareness of the dynamics of like, oh, capitalism will turn anything into try to turn it into something, find some kind of financial transaction.
Can I interrupt and just rephrase that just a tiny bit?
Sure.
Because I would I see how you react. I would prefer to say that greed and bullying, structural violence, is anchored deep into human society. It's been going on for thousands of years. Capitalism is a current expression of it. But I think the battle is with bullying and greed and people with power exerting it. And what I'm curious about is how, because the thing is, in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, we saw love and the ethos of love and a holistic approach that was compassionate and fully caring, integrating a bit into mainstream culture and commerce. And in the last 20, 30 years, that's melted away, and greed and structural violence has surfaced strongly in it. You know, how can love be brought into all of that?
Well, again, so we don't need, I'll sidestep the whole conversation about bullying and greed and capitalism, because I both agree and disagree some with your analysis. That would be an interesting conversation to have. But again, I don't think it's about bringing it in. I think it's about discovering it. I think that, you know, when I think about historically, at least here in the U.S., I'm much more familiar with the history in my country, like the 60s and 70s, there was a certain strata where love was being brought in. But that was also the year of, you know, those were the years of the Black Panther Party and Malcolm X and like a tremendous amount of racial strife. And so there was like a lot, there was a lot of reckoning that like my country, and I would argue that the UK as well, Britain as well, like we've never reckoned with our imperial history. We don't reckon with the violence. And that violence, when it's not reckoned with, becomes a shadow. And that shadow, unreckoned with, takes up a tremendous, like it's there, it comes out. And if we're not willing to like really face it, it's the same thing. It's like, it's why I think it's so important when facing business, like we have to face, like I wouldn't want to just say, oh, it's just bullying and greed. Like there's a structural piece of capitalism that needs to be faced. Otherwise, I don't know how else to find a healthy alternative to it if I'm not looking it in the eye and seeing it for what it is.
And 5 minutes ago, you were saying, see the love in it. You have to discover the love.
Yes.
In it.
Yes.
So how do you discover the love in that horrible thing you've just described, which is modern capitalism?
Well, you have to. So so when we face something, we ask the question. I ask the question, is love available even here? You know, everything, so according to Sufism, everything in this physical world of ours is made up of divine qualities. But the human being has the ability at the physical, like in, at the earthly level, of twisting, distorting, veiling them. And so they become distorted. And so if we can look underneath and find the qualities that are originally there, we can start to become instruments, expressions of divine care, of divine, we can be, we can bring healing and we can find other ways through. And I think that when we go down into that root, what is there, it's not about making capitalism right. It's like finding what was the twisting that created that twisted structure and finding completely different expressions. Which I don't think there's just one expression. I think that that's one of the challenges with the kind of world that we live in, is it's kind of like the same thing that we've done in agriculture. It's like this monocropping. Every local place, every local community needs to find its own unique expression. you know, the divine, when, you know, when the, you know, if I'm looking out my window at our little mini orchard here, and, you know, it's winter, and so it's not there, but ordinarily there'd be all kinds of wildflowers and things, and it's full of diversity, and I, you know, every, even all the flowers are the same, each one would be individual and unique, but when the human being does it, all we create are like exact replicas, you know, unless we're letting ourselves be individualized, you know, like we're letting our individual expressions come out. We let our unique qualities come out. We let ourselves be, as it says in Sufism, be the earth for your brothers and sisters, be the earth for your siblings, and help lift each other up so that, because without each of us, we're incomplete.
I'm just going to stay with this just a little bit, because there's something I would really like to understand more fully. Mm-hmm. And that's in facing full on the realities of the contemporary world and the power and the dynamics of what we're calling capitalism, is the finding of love in it. Is that, as an individual, I'm going, oh, I can be both exploring capitalism, looking at it, and simultaneously experiencing love, because everything is love? Or is it, I'm kind of a mental, intellectual kind of, I'm finding the bits of love in it that's out there? What is it, an experience or a perception? Because I'm looking for coming out of
right
judgmentalism,
let me make a slight tweak in terms of how Sufism talks about it. It's not that everything is love, it's that everything is the divine and is an expression of the divine, and the divine is expressed through multiple different qualities, and love is one of them, but it's not the only quality. And so when we look under something, when we're with something, we might not be experiencing love. We might be experiencing a different divine quality or multiple other divine qualities, wisdom, compassion, strength, the giver of life, you know, the knowingness. There's so many. There's 99 in Sufism, which really there's more than that. There's an experience. So I can look. It's a spiritual experience. So if I'm looking at something, you know, someone asked in the comments, like, how do you look under greed? You know, and so for instance, if I'm seeing a company, a person, like I can't look at it generally. I have to look at a specific situation and a specific person. Because if we do it generally, then we start to intellectualize and theorize and we become disconnected from the reality. We have to be there because each individual expression is unique. And so if I'm looking at something and I can see like, oh, there's greed happening in this company. What's really going on here? And if I start to ask and I start to look and I start to see more deeply there, what I might see, for instance, is that, oh, there's someone there who is feeling like this empty hole in them, and they're like needing love, or they're needing acceptance, or they're needing appreciation. And they don't know how to access. And these, you know, appreciation is a divine quality. Shakur, the appreciative. It's like to experience, like to be filled up with a sense of a quality of appreciation, like of really being appreciated. And so if that person doesn't know how to access that and doesn't like isn't supported in accessing that, then they keep looking. It's like that old joke. It's like, you know, what are you looking for? I'm looking for my keys. Where'd you drop them? I dropped them over there. Well, why are you looking over here? Because the light's better. It's like, you know, like they're stuck in this thing and they don't know where else to look. So they just keep taking more and more and more. It's like being thirsty and you keep drinking sand because that's the cup that you have hold of, but it doesn't quench anything. And then they get so fixated in that and so stuck in that. And they're so heedless of the effects of it. They've been kind of like the same way that my growing up, I was had the emotions shut down in me. So I didn't know how to cry. I didn't know how to grieve. So I'm separated from that. It's not a mistake that it's a lot of men who end up doing this because of how we're conditioned emotionally. And so they keep doing harm, trying to create more and more and more money and never being quenched. Meanwhile, creating incredible harm in the process. And the unique system of capitalism supports that and accelerates it instead of there being cultural boundaries and cultural checks and balances that might call that person to account. Instead, we have a culture that, and a structure and a system, a legal system that privileges profit, privileges corporate personhood, privileges these things. I mean, a lot of this is very US-centric, but I know that it's also more generally in Western culture. And the harm. And so we need to look deeper and we need to support each other in looking deeper. But looking deeper doesn't mean that we're going to come to this soft, nice, greeting card version of love. Like, first of all, love is like annihilating. Love is not like has many different qualities to it. It's, you know, it's something that is incredibly powerful. It can turn everything upside down. But there's also all of these other qualities. All of these other qualities that we can access and we can see, and it can give us strength. It can give individuals strength. It can give groups strength to face injustice and to start to do things differently, to do a business differently in the face of, you know, a really damaging economy. It can give us strength to band together. Like recently here in the US, the labor union stood up, standing up to some of the big companies. It feeds us in so many ways, but it's like that inner experience that we need to be able to access it and drink it in our own hearts, and we can support one another to do it. It's the spiritual path is both a collective path and an individual path. A collective because we need each other, an individual because there are certain things that only we can do in our own hearts to connect.
That, I applaud what you've just said. And it's a tough call to make of individual business owners who may just be sweetie pie therapists, or I want to have an organic fruit store. You know, it's a tough call to look that particular dragon in the face. You know?
Well, you're interviewing me to like talk in this really big way. So many times when we're working with clients, they don't have to have like an in-depth analysis of capitalism that I have and all of this. We can face things individually, you know, or in smaller areas. It's like change happens like when many people are focused on the small changes that they can make. And I think that what we can do, you know, like there are people who come to us that have very tender hearts. I mean, we all have very tender hearts. And I don't ask them to take on what I'm talking about now at that level. You know, we say like, okay, you know, can you find the love in your own heart? Can you find the divine in your own heart? Can you find the heart of your business? Can you start to connect with that? You know, can we encourage you to look at marketing? Is there a heart in your marketing? You know, who are the people you're trying to reach? How do we do that in a way that feels of integrity? You know, are there systems? What does the heart of your business tell you about certain systems that will help your business grow? And let's not think about systems from the twisted side, but let's think about the human body. This whole time I've been talking, I've been breathing, and I haven't had to think about the breathing. I haven't had to think about the carbon dioxide, oxygen exchange that's happening in the alveoli of my lungs. Like, I don't have to think about that because there's a system. It's doing that for me. We can bring systems into your business that help your business do things without having you bring your conscious attention to every single little thing it needs to do, which can be exhausting. And we do it step by step by step by step by step. You know, one of the first things that when this whole body of work that I'm doing really started to coalesce after some years, I began to really see that, you know, to steady focus on business development from creation all the way into what I call momentum, this third stage, where the business is really dependable, takes at an absolute minimum 18 months, but more normally 3 or 4 or 5 years. Because, and it's not that nothing's working and then suddenly it works at the end of 5 years. You know, you're growing and developing along the way. But because we need to have so much compassion with the growth process, it just takes time. It takes time to take on a new perspective. It takes time to try things iteratively. It takes time to do the physical work of developing the business, and it takes time and tenderness for your heart to come into relationship with these different aspects of the business.
Mm. So listen, this is the moment where I'm going to say to people who are watching and saying, hey, William, you spend too much time going into the politics of this, right? And I want to start a business. here's the book, and it will be in the follow-up email that you receive, right? So that will give you the nitty-gritties, and you can always connect with Mark directly. And
I won't be lecturing people on capitalism.
No. I tell you what I'm reminded of, which I find I've had to rein myself in. I imagine you have too. You know, you ever seen Tibetan Buddhist theologians having an enjoyable argument? With Tibetan Buddhist theologians, when they have an enjoyable argument, it's going, right? And then the other person goes,
I haven't.
And I see in Mark, I obviously poked the bear, and the punk political creature emerged, and we could have a lot of fun with that.
Yes,
but we are in a year of elections, and we are in a year. There's going to be elections in the U.S. and there's going to be elections in the United Kingdom. Those of you who are watching, and these issues are actually crucial, because the microcosmic issues of individuals, business people, and folk like us, it's our individual actions as well as our ideas and thinking that can have huge influence. And what we've seen, Mark, in the way you've been talking about it, is an absolutely macro awareness of the struggle and challenges humanity as a whole is facing at the moment, with a healing response that's to do with caring for the individual who's getting their business off the ground. And that's great.
Mm. Mm.
You're supposed to say something in response to that.
Am I? I was just taking it in. I just, sometimes you have to, you know, nudge me.
But you do, you have this macro perspective, which then comes down into helping at the micro level, which I think is just great.
Well, right. And, somehow my being likes to move like that. And it's, I think that it would be crazy making otherwise for me to not have some understanding of what's happening. It's kind of like the riptide, or like, if you keep getting, if you keep saying, God, why is everybody else doing, and why am I keep tripping up? It's like, well, it's good to understand what you're tripping on, and then maybe we can take some steps to avoid it. And we can also understand, like, one of the things that I like to say to people, like, when you're building a business, don't try to compensate for systemic problems with your own personal efforts. Like, we need to solve some of these things collectively. But don't harm yourself. You know, like, somebody, a lot of people come into business, they see people who have really struggled, they want to help those people, you know, who have had a really hard time. But then they're unwilling, you know, then they don't face the reality, like, oh, you have to price yourself so you can actually be sustained and so that your business can thrive. And you can have an awareness of, like, how can I build things into my business so that I can help people? Like, we have a whole pay from the heart approach, but there's structure to it to make sure that we don't go bankrupt, that we can still, you know, pay our team and pay ourselves while we're still helping people that don't have what other people have, you know, some structured way to create the sharing. But you have to, you don't want to harm yourself. My earliest mentor in activism, Lani Kaumanu, in bisexual activism, we had a conversation. She said, "Mark, you've got to take care of yourself. We need you around for the long term. We need you around for the long term, so you cannot burn yourself out with this work." And she'd been already an activist in lesbian and queer and bi circles for a couple of decades by the time I met her in the 80s. And it's something that I really took to heart. And it's the same thing with business. Like, if you're building a business, like, don't lose your caring for people and know that it's okay to focus, you know, to focus some attention on making sure that your business actually works. You can actually have money in your pocket and you can care for your loved ones and care for yourself. And then it becomes much more possible to reach business models that can care for other people. Like, the way that we've built a part of business, I would have never been able to support the kind of pay from the heart approach that we have now, where in our last class, we've had people paying us more than we were asking. We've also had people paying $1 US to take it. Like, there was like we were able to support that. But 20 years ago, you know, 15 years ago, I wouldn't have had the infrastructure and the audience and the business model to be able to help like that. So when we're in a spiritual, when we're walking spiritually in the world, one of the disconnects can happen. Like, so in Sufism, there's this thing called the imaginal world. There's this realm called the imaginal world referred to. And it's a place where ideas and symbols and things come up very quickly. You know, we have dreams, we have visions, we have things, they come up very quickly. And I think we may have noticed it takes a little longer for it to come into the physical world. You know, it doesn't come that rapidly. And we have to, you know, one of the things I love about Sufism is it says in various different ways, in different, various different contexts, you know, your body has certain claims upon you. Like, you have to pay attention to the physical world. The physical world is also a divine creation, and you need to respect and care for it. You know, we're growing fruit trees. I didn't plop a stick in the ground and get peaches immediately. It's like trees need different things at different times. Your business is going to need different things at different times, and it's going to be capable of giving different things at different times. This tree, the trees aren't giving fruit. They're giving other things, of course, but they're not giving fruit. And we're hoping to have enough fruit to be able to share with the larger community and be part of the larger food shed in this area. We're creating a food forest to want to contribute to food security in the area. It's the same thing with your business. Like, don't try to move too quickly to the point where you harm yourself, which is what the culture wants from us, to move too quickly, to use ourselves up. We're not going to get there doing it the way that we were told to do it. We're going to get there by allowing our feet to be on the ground, our heart to be open, for us to be taking the time to listen and to be the earth for one another and to care and to take steps with deliberation, sometimes very quickly, but not always, sometimes very slowly. Sorry, I was in a flow there.
That was beautiful. That was the perfect way to end. That's a take. Mm-hmm. That's a take. That was wonderful. That was a wonderful final set of words from you, Mark. I'm very, very grateful. Mm. Are we happy to close the circle now? Is there anything more you'd want to add as a
I mean, there's so much. I think it's perfect to stop.